afternoon, everyone. I'd like to call the Senate Resources Committee to order. Today is Wednesday, February the 15th, 2023. The time is 3:30:45 to be exact for right now. Please silence all cell phones. Members today are present: Co-Chair Kiesel, Vice Chair Wilikowski, Senator Matt Klayman, Senator Kawasaki will be along momentarily, Senator Kaufman, Senator Dunbar, myself, Co-Chair Bishop. Welcome. And we'd like to thank our support staff, Kari Cooper-Ryder, Amanda Kraft, just back there behind the wall. Thank you for supporting us today. Today's agenda is second hearing of SB 33 Renewable Energy Grant Fund with public testimony. We're going to have a statehood defense overview from the Department of Natural Resources, Department of Environmental Conservation, Department of Fish and Game, Department of Law. Senator Giesel will take the gavel at that point. Senate Bill 33, Renewable Energy Grant Fund, second hearing of SB 33. The committee previously set an amendment deadline for this bill. No amendments were received. Our intention is to hear public testimony and look to the will of the committee. Senator Kawasaki has joined us. Okay, we're going to gavel in and open public testimony. And is there anyone in the room that would like to testify? Senate Bill 33, please come forward, put yourself on the record in 2 minutes, please.
Thank you, Senator Bishop and senators on the committee. My name is Doug Woodby. I live in Juneau, and I represent 350 Juneau Climate Action for Alaska. And I'm here in support of Senate Bill 33. I don't have a lot to say about it. It's a very short bill as I read it, but I think it's important to extend it for at least another 10 years and to hopefully appropriate annually at least $50 million. I think this is an important bill that is particularly rural communities from the North Slope, Western Alaska, to Southeast can take advantage of. And I feel it's very important for the rapid transition that we need to make to renewable energy for sustainable communities in Alaska. And that's all I have. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. We're now going to go online. I believe we have a Mr. Matt Jackson from the Southeast Alaska Conservation Council in Sitka.
Hello, thank you, Chairman. My name is Matthew Jackson. I live in Sitka. I work for Southeast Alaska Conservation Council, whom I'm testifying on behalf of. I also work closely alongside of groups with the Alaska Climate Alliance, who met with many of you a few weeks ago, and I just before the meeting submitted a petition to this committee with 203 signatures from around the state, folks that want to support the Renewable Energy Fund. I think it is absolutely essential as we experience volatile energy prices that we keep this program running in the state, that we not let it expire, and I strongly encourage each of you to vote in favor of this bill. And I also want to take this time to echo Mr. Woodby's and many other people's sentiments. The Renewable Energy Fund has been wildly successful. It's funded more than 100 operational projects. I believe there's 44 more projects underway right now as we speak. It saves communities millions and millions of gallons of diesel every year. And with saving millions of gallons of diesel from being burned, also saved those communities millions and millions of dollars and millions of tons of carbon dioxide emissions. And so for those reasons, I hope that not only you'll extend it through SB 33, but that when the budget time comes around, you will advocate for it to be funded at a level appropriate to the scale of our state's needs. We have far too many communities still relying on diesel, and the Renewable Energy Fund is our most effective state program to help them transition to renewables. So I do hope that when budget time comes around, not only will this program be extended, but that it will be funded at about $50 million a year, which was the appropriation that was laid out for it when it was created in 2008. So thank you for this opportunity to testify. Thank you for hearing this bill, and I hope you'll all support it. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Jackson. Anyone else in the room wishing to testify? Seeing no one else online, public testimony is closed. Any questions for Senator Kaufman? Seeing none, I'm going to review the fiscal note. It's in your package. Department of Commerce, Community and Economic Development, Appropriations, the Alaska Energy Authority, OMB component number is 2888. It's 1210 is a fund source, Renewable Energy Fund. They're designated general funds, $1,401,000 a year throughout 2029. This bill extends the effective date of the Renewable Energy Grant Fund out through 2033. That's what it does. Any questions on the fiscal note? Seeing none. Seeing none, Senator Geisel.
I move Senate Bill 33, Work Order 33, LS0235/A-alpha out of committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note.
Seeing no objections, the bill is moved from committee. We'll take a brief at ease, sign the committee document, and
on to our next item on the agenda. We're going to hear an overview today of the statehood defense group of commissioners. So I would ask them to come forward. Department of Natural Resources, we have Commissioner Designee John Boyle. From the Department of Environmental Conservation, we have Commissioner Jason Burney. From the Department of Fish and Game, we have Deputy Commissioner Ben Mulligan. And from the Department of Law, Deputy Attorney General Corey Mills. So welcome to all of you. As you put yourself on the record and you change speakers, please identify yourself, of course, for the record. Thanks very much for being here. I'll let you begin, Commissioner Burney.
Thanks, Co-Chair Geisel, Co-Chair Bishop, members of the committee. Thank you so much for the opportunity to testify today. For the record, my name is Jason Bruni, and I'm the Commissioner of the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation. And I'm so excited to talk about the efforts that we've been implementing for the last 2 years to defend our state. We have a great group of folks that meet on a weekly basis every Thursday at 2:30 for an hour. We have the commissioners of Fish and Game, Doug Vincent Lang, and his deputy, Ben Mulligan. We have the commissioner of DNR, John Boyle, as well as both of his deputies. We have the AG, along with Corey and four attorneys from the Department of Law that meet every week, Ron Upsall, Ann Nelson, and Julie Pack. We also have myself and Emma Pocon. And we put lengthy agendas together every single week and talk about how our state is under attack and what we can do to defend our state and to have self-determination for our state. So this is a great group. We have amazing discussions. We strategize. We have such a great relationship in planning these things. And I think it's so important, first of all, to thank you for the $2 million that you gave to the Department of Law last year for these efforts, along with $500,000 specifically for Tongass efforts. I also want to remind the committee that a $10 million appropriation has been requested for this year within the governor's office for all of our departments and the efforts that we're doing. And really excited again to be able to present about the efforts that that we're engaging in. So as I mentioned, the four departments work extensively together on this issue, and statehood defense is not just about litigation. Statehood defense is about preparing for the potential of litigation, but that preparation is the baseline science that we have. We have the expertise to know about Alaska. We have to make sure the Alaska Department of Fish and Game, DEC and DNR, are allowed to do that science, not just rely on the federal government science. We have to make sure that we're developing comments and making the record as Alaska-specific as we possibly can. Then, obviously, if appropriate, litigation may be necessary or participating in amicus roles, partnering with other states. It's incredibly important that we engage with other states that are also being impacted by federal policies that, from a 10th Amendment perspective, are impacting all of us. So what is it ultimately? Why statehood defense? Obviously, we were admitted into the union. And as a federalist society, obviously, we want to have control of our own destiny. And when it specifically is dealing with the use, conservation, management of our lands, our waters, and our natural resources, we're going to be the ones that have our best interests in mind. There's a number of federal pieces of legislation that we focus on. Obviously, of course, the most important is the Constitution, and then the Foundation, obviously, the Statehood Act, the Federal Submerged Lands Act, the Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act, and, of course, the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act are very important when we're talking about protecting our right to manage our land, our waters, our fish, and our wildlife. So, as I was saying, the way we limit overreach into these issues, obviously, is through the collaboration we talk about, but the development of that science. And Deputy Commissioner Mulligan is going to talk about some of the science that ADF&G does with respect to polar bears and others. The record and comment development that we do across the board. We share the comments. We make sure that we're all aligned. And we don't always agree, but we come to an agreement. We talk out the issues to make sure what's best for Alaska. And then, of course, as I indicated, there are times where we have litigation that we have to pursue. We sometimes intervene with other states. We, of course, can provide amicus briefs as well. And I think what's also important, as I indicated, is that collaboration with other states of like-minded issues to make sure when either getting resolutions passed through things like the Environmental Council of States or the Western States Water Coalition, or getting multi-state letters to comment on things, getting the federal agencies to understand this isn't just about Alaska. This is about many states. It's very important. And so, of course, we need to, of course, engage each other, talk with our stakeholders, talk with you to make sure that we're in line with what you want us to be doing. And then we have amazing expertise within the Department of Law and within the departments that we're talking about. But there are times where we have to engage outside scientists as well as outside counsel. And what I'm going to turn over right now as we talk about the resources that you've given us in the past and the $10 million we're requesting in the governor's budget this year, I want Deputy Commissioner or Deputy AG Corey Mills to talk a little bit about this.
Thank you. Again, for the record, hold that maybe a little bit closer. There we go. Hopefully I'm coming across clearly enough. So for the record, Corey Mills, Deputy Attorney General overseeing the Civil Division for the Department of Law. I think you're going to see a lot more of me on Friday when we come back and kind of really go through the litigation. So I'm not going to do that today. But I think to Commissioner Bruni's point, over the past 2 years, the legislature has graciously given us $6.5 million total to pursue some of these efforts. We have a federal law and litigation report we come out with every year for the legislature. That list is actually 47 total cases. That does not cover everything we cover with this funding. We kind of have different pots of funding that we use for different sources, as well as making sure that we're in line with what the legislature intended for that money. So the list you see in this slide is the current list of cases that are being funded through this multi-year statehood defense funding. And I would expect that list to increase by 3 or 4, actually, in the next couple of months because of some upcoming matters, definition of waters of the United States. We had the recent Tongass roadless rule. So there are some other matters that are likely to be added to this list in the next 60 to 90 days. But I think what's important to note here is, as I said, we have about $6.5 million total that was appropriated. We've spent about close to half of that. And if you look at this list in terms of the anticipated costs, and these are higher estimates, I would say we really wanted to capture what it could cost. They may be cheaper than this, but you're looking at about $8.7 million. We got $6.5. So you can already see there's a potential nexus issue there.
I see. Is there a question? Yes, Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Deputy Attorney General Mills, and I apologize. This is my first year on this body, and so if this question was already answered last year, I apologize for that. But I'm curious when we provide the Department of Law funds or any departments, how do we know that it will go to this kind of litigation? So, for example, the governor recently signed on, so the state of Alaska is now party to a case that is attempting to restrict the ability of Alaskans to access certain kinds of birth control. So how do I know that the funds go to these kind of lawsuits and not to, anti-birth control lawsuits?
So through the chair, Senator Dunbar, no, that's a great question. We have, the way we manage our cases, we have a case management system. Each of those cases is pointed to a funding source. That funding source can be undesignated general fund. That funding source can be another department's reimbursable services agreement if they're paying for the litigation. In this case, we have a fund code. In fact, we have three for the $4 million that was originally given, $2 million from last year, and the $500,000 specifically for Tongass to make sure that those matters are pointed appropriately and funded in the correct manner. And we also have outside counsel contracts. Those are the same way. I review most of those invoices and make sure that the correct funding source is pointed for the correct invoice for the correct matter. So there's that's kind of the way we manage it. And so this list is the list of the matters that are pointed. Just to clarify on the abortion-related case, because I know that's been in the news a lot recently, that was an amicus brief, so I just want to be clear. We did not join that case. We are not a party to that case. It was an amicus brief that specifically supported a state's right to regulate that sort of public health care. Can it come through the mail system? It does not change or seek to change any of the laws relating to abortion in Alaska.
That's a brief follow-up.
Yes, follow-up. Senator Dunbar.
So, I mean, you just said it's a state's rights. So we're asserting a statehood defense. So that seems like it could fit pretty easily into, I assume we don't fund specific lawsuits. You're asking for a pot of money that generally goes to state's rights. And so, you know, how do you make that distinction? And then also, what's the recourse? I mean, what if you did, the Department of Law did decide to use that as a fund source? What recourse does the legislature have?
So through the chair, Senator Dunbar, first of all, we do point to specific matters. So it is not, I mean, yes, does our budget end up coming out in the wash, so to speak? It's all state money at the end of the day. But we are very specific about which fund sources and where they're pointed, and they have specific funding codes. So you can go back and audit and figure out which cases have been funded in which manner. So I can assure you that those cases have not been pointed there. In addition, because we sign on to an amicus brief, it actually doesn't really cost. I would say it costs someone, you know, 10 minutes of time, maybe. An attorney, maybe an hour reviewing. But we don't really charge that in any way because it's not a significant amount of time. So that's just, I'd love to explain kind of how there's a lot of, I know we have some here who understand much more about the department's budget, but I'd be happy to follow up with further conversations just so you can have assurances about how we do that.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Certainly. And Senator Dunbar, there's no inappropriate questions. You ask great questions that, remember, our audience is not just this room. It's the folks listening online, and you're asking great questions. So thank you for that. Senator Klayman.
So I want to – these are directly in follow-up to Senator Dunbar's questions. As to the Texas suit, what the newspaper reports is the Attorney General joined the lawsuit, and it's just been filed – and my understanding has always been that amicus briefs come much later, typically in a status in which it's on appeal before one of the circuit courts or on appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court. But the way the news is reporting the lawsuit, which was yesterday, is this is a new lawsuit and we're a party plaintiff. Am I getting something wrong, or has the news got it completely mistaken?
Through the chair, Senator Klayman, I believe in this case the news did misreport, and we did not catch it in time to correct them on that because they didn't really give us an opportunity to see what they were writing. They just asked us for a statement, but I think there was a misunderstanding about what our role was, where the litigation was, and exactly what we had joined on to. Okay. If that's the way, I believe I read most of the stories, but if that's the way it was reported, then that is inaccurate.
Okay.
Follow up.
So to a somewhat different topic or different subject matter, but related to Senator Dunbar's question, last year the legislature was very specific in some of the funding for both statehood defense and other matters that were special litigation, and I'm talking about the Janus suit. Mm-hmm. And the intent of the legislature, as I understood it, was essentially – you shall no longer participate in the Janus suit. But my understanding is that you continue to participate in the Janus suit. And so my query is when we try to express our preference that you not participate in certain matters, our wish, as the commissioner would say, do you follow that? And for example, Janice, how does it work out that we say, stop, we don't want you to spend money, we're the appropriators, and nevertheless you continue?
So through the chair, Senator Klayman, the Janice matter was about spending outside council dollars on that lawsuit. It was not about not participating at all. Last year's budget actually did not have that distinction that had been in the prior year's budgets, but I will tell you that we are no longer using outside counsel for that case.
Follow-up?
All right.
Just one last. I guess the query is, if the legislature, I mean, for example, on a topic for this year's budget, Pebble, you all are actively talking about reengaging in Pebble. If we as a legislature choose that we want to say, thou shalt not spend money on Pebble, how do we do that? Because it sounds like if we say, well, don't spend on outside counsel, then you say, oh, well, we just won't spend it on outside counsel. We'll take it in-house, which, of course, takes away from other matters that we might think were a higher priority. How do we express that desire as to some of these statehood defense came, abortion pill related things that may or may not exactly fit in statehood defense, but if it's our view that we don't want you spending money in that way, even if it's AG's doing the work, how do we do that effectively? Because it sure feels like we've tried to do it and you haven't listened.
So through the chair, Senator Klayman, this is an area where I think there's a fundamental disagreement between the legislature on what the appropriation power does versus the confinement clause in substantive law. The Attorney General has the authority over litigation and litigation decisions, and including contracting with outside counsel, and that is a substantive statute. And so we have letters that I'm happy to share that give our position on those issues. We have tried to adhere to the intent, but saying you can or cannot enter into certain types of lawsuits is a substantive law issue about the Attorney General's role and position, and a separation of powers issue. Again, that's not really the topic of today. We have been, in terms of the money here, we have been very strict about how we spend it. For example, there is a clause in the appropriation that specifically says you shouldn't spend it on subsistence-related cases, and we are not spending it on subsistence-related cases. So we have really focused on natural resources and the purposes of these different departments in the natural resource management arena.
Senator Wilikowski, question?
Well, I had some more questions on Janice, and I was just looking up, and I know my recollection is different than yours, and I'm looking at a letter that was sent to the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee, and based on that letter, there was a very clear violation. The administration was directed not to spend any funds on Janice, and they violated that. So I guess that's my concern. I'm all for defending states' rights, but when we put a specific provision in the budget and say, don't spend it on this, and you go ahead and spend it on that, not you personally, but the administration, that is a breach of trust. And it makes it difficult for the legislature to say, as Senator Dunbar discussed and Senator Klayman, we want to fund a lot of these things, but we want to also know that we're the appropriating body and that the funds will be used as we direct that they be used. So it's more of a comment. But I know you're asking for a significant amount of money for these things, and I think you're going to find a lot of support for them. But we just also need to know that don't overstep the lines when we put parameters on how that money is to be used.
Thank you. I'll let you go ahead and continue. Deputy Commissioner Mills, were you finished? Okay, great.
For the record, Jason Bruni, DEC Commissioner. We're now going to transition to each of the commissioners and the departments to talk about specific issues that we are working on that come up at Statehood Defense. First of all, though, I want to give you a little teaser for Friday, especially for Senator Wilikowski, Senator Dunbar, and Senator Klayman, the attorneys. You are going to be in for a treat on Friday. There are four amazing attorneys that work for the state of Alaska: Julie Pack, Ron Upsall, Thad Atkins, and Jesse Alloway are going to give just amazing presentations on Friday. I've had the privilege of listening to them at our meetings. They are amazing, and it's I'm excited for you, and I'm excited to hear it myself. So get ready for some amazing presentations on Friday. So with respect to DEC, first of all, as I have said, many of you, I think this is my ninth hearing this week or something like that I'm testifying on. So if you've heard me say this over and over again, I apologize. But we as a state, as part of state of defense, we want to be the folks that are controlling our own destiny. And one way to control your own destiny is to take control of federal programs that are passed by Congress. But under a federalist society, you have the opportunity to get primacy of those programs. We have primacy over the Safe Drinking Water Act, over the Clean Air Act, over the NPDES program. We've just recently been given funding for the RCRA program, the Resource Conservation Recovery Act, which is the handling of hazardous waste. And, of course, in the governor's amended budget that just came out today, you'll see approximately $5 million for the assumption of the 404 dredge and fill program. And many of you have heard me talk about that, and I testified earlier in the week on that. So that's one way to make sure you're defending the state is to take control of your own destiny.
One moment, Senator or Congressman. Commissioner Bruni, Senator Kawasaki has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just had a question about this because we're talking in terms of state of defense. The money that is in the budget is I think it's going to the Department of Natural Resources or Department of DEC to implement and staff up primacy. Are we to believe that if there is that we're also spending state of defense money on that separately, or is that just an aside that it's part of this?
Through the chair, Senator Kawasaki, that's just an aside. The $10 million that's being proposed in the governor's budget is for the preparation of comments, science, and litigation. The 404 assumption efforts, the RCRA efforts, those are separate budget items.
Follow-up, Senator Kawasaki?
Thank you. So I guess in terms of the state of defense discussion, then where – if we were to not fund this particular portion of the Section 404 permitting, I guess where in the budget is that then? Is it in DEC's budget right
through
now?
Through the chair, Senator Kawasaki.
To defend it would also be in that DEC budget?
Through the chair, Senator Kawasaki, yes. And I apologize for the confusion that this slide may cause. It is a completely separate item in DEC's budget. The state, it is a component of statehood defense, is taking control of your own destiny and having the primacy programs, but it is not within the $10 million is proposed for in the governor's statehood defense budget.
Okay. Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On the four that we've implemented primacy already, or that we have primacy already, how's the staffing? Do we have enough staff to implement these programs in a timely manner, or are you getting complaints from industry about the lack of staffing?
Senator Wilikowski, through the chair, thanks so much for that question. With respect to the RCRA program that we just got permission from the legislature to pursue, the EPA had one half of one position located in Seattle. For that program, we proposed six positions, and in our discussions through our application process, they're saying they think that might not be enough. So one half of one person versus six that we're proposing, I think we're going to absolutely have enough for that program, but of course we're in the application process. For the Safe Drinking Water Act, absolutely we have sufficient staff. For the NPDES program, which we took primacy over in 2008 through 2012, we brought forward 41 positions. We get regular report cards on that, and 4 years ago they gave us not the greatest of reports, the EPA did, because they do regular reports, and they said you need to have more enforcement staff. So I came before this body and requested four additional enforcement staff, and now they're giving us all sorts of glowing reports. So we're at perfect staffing levels for the NPDES program. And then with Clean Air Act, we have three new SIPs that the federal government is putting on us right now. Normally we do one every couple of years. There's going to be three that we're having to do in the next couple of years. So there is a request in the governor's budget for 10 additional positions. Eight of those are for the development of the SIPs. Two of those are for a network for doing air quality science, so we understand where are the impacts of air, either from forest fires, from Russia and China and coal burning, or from other things, we need to make sure we have the science to understand where those air impacts are coming from. So there will be 10 additional positions requested to help maintain that primacy program.
Have you been getting any complaints or lags in permitting time regarding Clean Air Act from industry?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, we did get some requests from industry for expediting our permit processing, but generally we meet all of the timelines that are laid out. They just want it quicker. And obviously, as we all know, a drilling season, for example, if you don't meet a certain timeline, we have a year to respond. They might want it in 9 months, so they might want it a little quicker. So those kind of requests have come forward, but we have never missed a deadline for that we have in place for permits for the industry from the clean air perspective.
All right, I'll let you continue.
Thank you. So obviously it's important, as I said, that you develop the record. You have to make sure that you are telling the agencies as they're making these important rules, Alaska's perspective, tell our story. And there's a number of issues that I think this committee would be very interested in that we've commented on recently. Of course, the waters of the United States. We've seen a roller coaster of a ride over the last 8 years on the definition of WOTUS, and most recently we've seen the Biden administration come forward with an ever-expanding definition of waters of the United States, and we're very concerned about that. We submitted extensive comments on that. Of course, as was mentioned earlier, the 404C issue. Of course, I want to make sure it's put on the record that that effort is not just about PEBBLE. There are 41 additional claims in the area that was preemptively vetoed by the EPA that are not owned by PEBBLE in the area. And so that's 309 square miles. So this is definitely not just about PEBBLE. It's about a process as well as states' rights on that one. PM 2.5, a number of you are from Fairbanks. You understand the impact there. We have to make sure we're developing our SIPs. We have primacy of the program. We believe we can improve air quality in Fairbanks and make sure that we're not having an adverse impact on the economy. It's an issue that we have spent extensive time, and there's going to be a public hearing on the 7th or the 9th of March on that issue. So it's important to have the comment development on that. The avgas issue. Rural Alaska relies on avgas. Everett's Air Cargo, I think, is the largest user of avgas in the world. And bringing in goods to rural Alaska, when the federal government, this is deja vu all over again, Senator Begich and Senator Murkowski wrote letters 12 or 14 years ago on this exact issue, and it's just rearing its ugly head again, so we had to submit another comment to say that this will have a significantly larger impact on Alaska than it will anywhere else. And of course, the oil and gas methane rule, this is something we are definitely the canary in the coal mine when it comes to climate change. No one is impacted more by climate change than Alaska. However, we are not generally contributing to the release of methane. Of course, we always have said, because of state law, we've been caring about greenhouse gases before caring about greenhouse gases was cool. We reinject all of the methane up on the North Slope. We use it for enhanced oil recovery. The Lower 48, the EPA, they don't remember that we have these requirements in place. They don't remember that we have an environmental ethic that is better than anyone in Texas or Wyoming or Colorado. We do it right. We have to continually remind them of that issue. And so that's why the methane rule, when they're proposing to penalize maintenance activities and allow third-party observers, we have to make sure we're telling Alaska's story. Of course, we have to make sure our perspective is heard on a number of other issues. Arctic policy, I think many of you will have just seen that President Biden just named a new Arctic ambassador. I'm excited that it's an Alaskan. We were begging for it to be an Alaskan, and I think Ambassador Designee Shraga, thank you, is going to be fantastic. It's great to have an Alaskan in that role, but we had to advocate for that. We also, and Commissioner Vincent Lang and myself have said this time and time again, we're not just a stakeholder here. We are the reason we are an Arctic nation. And we're being told by the Biden administration, here's the policy we're going to be put in place. We've told them, no, we need to be developing this policy with you. We're not just a stakeholder. We are the ones that should be developing this. We are the ones that should be developing what science needs to be done. So keen emphasis for Commissioner Vincent Lang and myself and now Commissioner Boyle. Environmental justice, of course, we're constantly under attack by the federal administration talking about environmental justice issues. In Alaska, environmental justice is a job. We're able to tell them that places like Red Dog, places like the North Slope Borough, and Chair Giesel, you've brought this up time and time again. We've seen increases in life expectancy in those areas greater than any other place in the United States because of the economic opportunities that Red Dog and oil development on the North Slope provide, the ability to maintain cultures and maintain subsistence lifestyles and people to stay in their traditional villages. But for those economic opportunities, that wouldn't happen. And so we have to make sure we're pointing that component of environmental justice out. EJA, we've received billions of dollars in infrastructure funding. We have to make sure we're pointing out from a statehood defense perspective and from a budgetary perspective, you can throw all this money at Alaska for doing what we need to do, upgrading the 32 communities that are still on honey buckets, but who's going to be paying for that long-term operation and maintenance? It might be us. And so we have to make sure we're making that message clear to the federal government. A number of other issues I've already mentioned, greenhouse gas analysis and the methane rule, human health criteria, and of course, toxic release inventory. The way Alaska is known for having two of the top five largest releasers of toxic materials in the United States at Red Dog and at Greens Creek. And the way they classify it is if you take a rock overburden and you move it from here to here, that's called a release. Whereas you have entities in the lower 48 that are manufacturers that are spewing all sorts of nasties into the air or they're dumping things in the water. Those are actual releases, but they're lower on the list because of the way they classify it. So we have to make sure we're making sure that the EPA is paying attention to that and trying to change the way they identify the toxic release inventory. Final things I want to talk about, we have to make sure we're holding the federal government accountable. They have high standards that they're putting on industry, but they don't look themselves in the mirror. One of these prime examples that we brought litigation against the federal government on is contamination on the indigenous lands of our state. The Alaska Native people 51 years ago effectively agreed to a treaty that gave them 44 million acres, or more importantly, probably gave us 320 million acres of their acreage to be able to settle their indigenous land claims. And they were given damaged goods. And for years, we have been asking the Obama administration, the Trump administration, and then the Biden administration, clean up your mess. You are the responsible parties. These lands were contaminated while the federal government owned them. You need to clean them up because it shouldn't be the responsibility of the Alaska Native people to clean them up. And Secretary Holland, who is an indigenous woman who grew up on a contaminated site in New Mexico, the first indigenous woman to be the head of the Department of Interior, has said, no, we are not going to be the entity that is responsible for doing this. Totally dumbfounding to us. And so we sued them. Governor Dunleavy instructed us to sue them, and they're challenging our suit, which is just dumbfounding to me. So that's one thing we got to hold them accountable to make sure they're cleaning up. And that's an environmental justice issue as well. And then, of course, Senator Kawasaki, you'll understand the wood stove issue up in Fairbanks. 90% of the air quality issues in Fairbanks are because of wood stoves. The EPA is responsible for certifying those wood stoves, and they put their head in the sand. So they're allowing wood stoves that claim they're only emitting this much to emit this much. And yet they're saying we need to spend upwards of $300 million on upgrading the point source folks up there that aren't even going to really have a significant impact on the problem. So holding federal agencies accountable is one of the issues that we focus on as well. With that, I want to transition to my colleague from the Department of Natural Resources. We are so lucky to have John and his amazing expertise from his time at the North Slope Borough and in the private sector. I am very fortunate to work with him, and I'll turn the floor over to him.
But before you do, yes. Senator Dunbar has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And if we could roll back one slide and up in – I want you to – I don't quite understand why – maintenance and operations for IIJA-funded facilities is in a DEC statehood defense presentation. If we were talking to the Department of Transportation or the Department of Health about ongoing operations, I get it. But how is this part of statehood defense? Are you going to be lobbying? Are you going to be litigating over this? Can you clarify that for me?
Sure, Senator Dunbar, through the chair. Thanks. Great question. We have the Village Safe Water Program and the State Revolving Loan Fund that helps put infrastructure into rural Alaska for wastewater and water. And so it's not necessarily something that we discuss at length during the statehood defense meetings, but it is a statehood defense issue in that if they don't provide funding for us to have the ongoing O&M, it's going to be each of you as appropriators that are responsible for providing that money going forward. In addition, the water director from EPA, Radhika Fox, has told us that she wants us to bypass the requirements for the scoring for managerial, technical, and financial requirements that communities have to be able to get that infrastructure put into those communities. She wants us to ignore that and just put the infrastructure into rural Alaska without having that capacity. That's going to make that infrastructure not be well taken care of, and it's going to make it so that ultimately it will not the life expectancy of those that infrastructure will be way shorter than it should be. That's a statehood defense issue because it's ultimately going to cost us the money to have to repair and to maintain those systems, and so we hold them accountable for that.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think I'm still a little puzzled by why it's here and how you're going to use those funds to effectuate that, but I'll let us keep going. I'm sorry. Thank you, Madam
Senator Dunbar, I'll talk with you afterwards to give you some more clarity on that. Thank you for the question.
Co-Chair Bishop.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Did she put that in writing, the lady from the EPA?
Co-Chair Bishop, she has come to us multiple times. I have not seen it in writing. We have said that's a violation of the Safe Drinking Water Act for them to have that, to waive that requirement. And if they want to mandate that, put it in federal legislation, but they have not done that.
All right. Switching to DNR.
Good afternoon, Chair Giesel. Co-Chair Bishop and members of the committee, my name is John Boyle. I'm the Commissioner Designee for the Department of Natural Resources, and it's a pleasure to be in front of you today. From DNR's perspective on statehood defense, you know, we're looking at this through the prism of the Alaska Statehood Act. And of course, as you all know, the state of Alaska received a substantial land entitlement at the date of statehood, approximately 105 million acres. As there was a realization at the time that Alaska needed such lands and natural resources to make a go of it, you know, so that we could stand on our own feet economically and not become a ward of the federal government. This land entitlement is particularly important to Alaska because of its unique circumstances. You know, our distance from the rest of the lower 48, our extreme climate, our size, and great distances between many of our communities are unrivaled or unparalleled in other states, and the paucity of our paved roads and established land-based transportation systems, all of these things, you know, contribute to what makes us unique as a state and what contributes to some of the special needs that we have. And of course, as we've crossed over the threshold of statehood, people generally understood that Alaska's future success as a state was tied to its abundant and diverse natural resources. And Alaska will continue to find its economic well-being and prosperity tied to its oil and gas resources, its minerals, its fish and game, its timber. And whether that's through traditional uses or through innovative means, through like carbon offset and sequestration programs, or expanded diverse tourism opportunities, et cetera, you know, these are all efforts that are fundamental to our prosperity and well-being as a state, is having access to these resources. And all of our wealth is inherently meaningless if we don't have access to them. You know, it's only through the ownership, management, and control of vital transportation corridors such as rivers, lakes, tidal waters, and so on, our RS-2477 rights of ways, and other state land-based easements, that Alaskans can reach each other, can reach the vast resources of our state, and ultimately reach the markets that we need to deliver our resources to. So this is why the importance of statehood defense from our perspective can't be overstated. And through statehood defense initiatives, DNR is striving to secure for all Alaskans, both now and into the future, the rights to enjoy the promises made to us at statehood. And moving on to our next slide, you know, statehood promises pursuant to the Equal Footing Doctrine, the Alaska Statehood Act, and the Federal Submerged Lands Act, the ownership, management, and control of all submerged lands under navigable, in fact, and tidally influenced waters that were made to Alaska, just as they were to all other states. The only difference is that Alaska, unlike other states, has only received federal acknowledgement of state ownership to approximately 9% of its rivers and 16% of its lakes statewide. And as we all know, our rivers and other waters are in reality our real highways of commerce and of trade and of travel to many areas, many parts of our states. And of course, without them, our vast resources would be out of reach and inaccessible for our continued health and economic prosperity. And so with that, I will defer now to Deputy Director Goodrin, who can walk us through the work being done by our public access assertion and defense team, which, you know, I don't know, Senator Klayman, if you have retirement plans, but the PAD group has one of the coolest jobs in the state. Their jobs are to, you know, travel out to rivers and determine navigability, which usually involves a raft and camping equipment and high adventures in some of the most beautiful corners of our state. So anyways, it's really one of the best jobs, I think, within the department, and Deputy Commissioner Goodrin can explain, in addition to having great adventures, the really important work that this group is doing for us.
Thank you, Commissioner Designee. Deputy Commissioner Brent Goodrum, can you hear us?
Yes, ma'am. Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Deputy Commissioner Goodrum, I believe, are we on slide 17 now?
Yes, we are.
Excellent. Thank you. On the second anniversary of the Sturgeon II Supreme Court decision in March of 2021, Governor Dunleavy announced his Unlocking Alaska initiative to help recognize the ownership and management rights that Alaska has held since statehood on navigable waters. Essentially, Alaska was no longer going to patiently wait for our federal agencies to tell us that we could manage our own lands. Alaska was going to act like the rightful landowner that it was. This slide, although very busy, depicts a multifaceted approach that the Dunleavy administration is taking while exercising its ownership rights. If you start at about the 5 o'clock position there, the heightened number of RDI applications, RDI stands for Recordable Disclaimers of Interest, and those are supposed to be quick and easy with the federal government for them to acknowledge or disclaim their interest. However, they are neither quick nor easy. And in fact, since the state had last filed suit on the North Fork and Middle Fork of the 40 Mile River a handful of years back, the Bureau of Land Management has not issued a single RDI determination, even though their staff has grown to about 10 or 11 members there over the last couple of years. As you work clockwise around this, we talk about asserting management of state submerged lands and federal areas. The state has communicated directly with Department of Interior and U.S. Forest Service leadership about the submerged lands that we intend and are managing. As Commissioner Bruni mentioned, we are being more aggressive and commenting in state and federal land planning processes about the state's ownership rights and its interests. Within our Department of Natural Resources, we've got a NAV waters map in which we display for all Alaskans to be able to see which water bodies are navigable so that they know who it is that has jurisdiction on those water bodies when they're out there recreating. Last year, there was legislation that went before the Senate and passed unanimously looking to codify our state-owned navigable waters within federal areas. And it's our hope that we'll likely see legislation introduced again potentially this year, looking to expand upon that work that started last year. And the last thing I'll point out at the top of the slide here, intensifying quiet title litigation against the federal government, we'll demonstrate that on the next slide. As you can see here, these are pending cases that we have that Assistant Attorney General Ron Opsahl will probably talk in great detail about on Friday. But the first course case there, the North Fork and Middle Fork, BLM has already disclaimed about 80% of the submerged lands that are currently in that litigation. That seems to be the case that we have with the Bureau. Often we have to go through a protracted litigation process, and generally BLM at the last moment disclaims all interest in the matters before we get a ruling on the court. But thus far, they've only disclaimed interest in about 80% of it, and we are still pursuing, I believe, summary judgment on that case. And as I mentioned, the attorney on Friday will give you more details. We've got a number of cases already pending in federal court. We've got a number of water bodies that we've have expired 180-day quiet title notices, and so that we are available or ready to file litigation when the state is ready. And we also have a number of water bodies that we've already done the field work on and are ready to serve additional 180-day notice quiet title action notices of intent. I'll pause to see if there's any questions on this slide.
Thank you, D.C. Goodrum. There is, in fact, Senator Klayman has a question.
Great.
I wanted a little more clarification in the position the state's taking. As I understand the Sturgeon case and some of the discussions you're having, the title we're seeking is actually to the submerged lands, and that's based on a finding that the water body is navigable and navigability makes it a federal water body. Have I got that straight?
Through the chair, Senator Klayman, you're close there. If the water body is navigable, in fact, then the submerged lands beneath that water body are rightfully held by the state of Alaska. We're not talking about management or activities within the water body, but the ownership of the submerged land beneath it.
Right. Further follow-up, Senator Klayman?
I think I did have that right, which was that the federal government owns the navigable waters, both lakes and rivers, and that's, I think, related to Title or Section 10 of the Rivers and Harbors Act. And when you're filing quiet title actions, you're not filing quiet title actions to the rivers. You're filing quiet title claims to the submerged lands underneath the rivers and underneath the lakes. I see Ms. Mills nodding her head, or apparently wanting to answer the question. But I,
Assistant Attorney General.
Yeah, so Deputy Attorney General Corey Mills for the record. So Senator Klayman, I think you're on the right track. It gets very confusing because multiple different laws and constitutional principles have to do with navigability, because you have the Commerce Clause as well, things like that. But when it comes to the submerged lands, it's the ownership of the lands. But the federal government doesn't own the river. It's just that they can regulate it in certain ways. But Sturgeon said that under, ANILCA and the Submerged Lands Act and the Equal Footing Doctrine, that in terms of regulations, the state has that ownership and can determine, for example, in that case, a hovercraft. We said a hovercraft was okay. And the Supreme Court agreed with us on that. So it depends on the body of law you're looking at for the applicability. And I don't know if Deputy Commissioner Brent Goodrum has more to say on that, but it does get a little, it's very dependent on which area and which area of regulation you're talking about.
All right, follow up, Senator Klayman.
And I think this is to Ms. Mills. And that would mean in terms of not the navigability, which is not a quiet title action. The quiet title relates to the land. The navigability gets to the question about, are there certain navigable rivers that nevertheless, because of more complicated things, which ultimately has to be taken on a river by river or a stream by stream or a lake by lake determination, there may be some that the state can either exercise exclusive control over regulating that water, or they do it concurrently with the federal government, or they have no power over it.
Through the chair, Senator Klayman, I think that's accurate, and I'll make sure that Ron Opsahl, when he comes on Friday, can kind of he's much more the expert in this than I am. But I think you're, like I said, I think we're on the right track, and I'll just make sure that Ron addresses that.
Thank you.
That'd be great. Thank you so much. Senator Wilikowski.
I'm trying to understand the impacts if we win some of these cases. For example, the Mendenhall River, Mendenhall Lake case. We sued a quiet title. We win. What changes?
Deputy Commissioner Goodrum.
Yes, through the chair, Senator Wilikowski. Simply what that means is that the Forest Service acknowledges the state as an adjacent landowner. And if they were to desire to build a dock or a structure in the submerged lands of the lake, they simply would come to us for an authorization, a permit, which we would grant, but they would recognize the state as an adjoining landowner in that situation.
Follow up, Senator Wilikowski.
Okay, so if you win the case, then you can build a dock on Mendenhall Lake. Is that the understanding? Or someone can build a dock on Mendenhall Lake and they can't do it now? Did I understand you correctly?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, essentially uses and activities on the lake would fall to the state as the landowner, and so we would be the entity that would rightfully say, you know, either boating traffic is appropriate or not appropriate on said lake or river. As opposed to the Forest Service that wants to unilaterally make those decisions regardless of ownership of the lake.
Follow up.
And my understanding was just reading, you know, sort of my recollection of where the Juneau representatives were on that bill or that lawsuit was the people at Juneau were fine with the way Mendenhall Lake and Mendenhall River were being managed. Was there some sort of an uprising, or were they the people of Juneau not really happy with that and wanting a change?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, it is just part of the process in which we're evaluating water bodies from a navigability perspective, and as a landowner, ensuring that our ownership rights and considerations are being addressed and considered. And so that's essentially where we are, I believe, with Mendenhall Lake. And we can talk about it again some more on Friday.
And just, I guess, maybe a comment. But, again, you know, I think certainly we want to assert our state's interest, but we have limited funds and limited ability to do it. There's probably – we've got 3 million lakes or 30 million lakes and some enormous amount of lakes and waterways in this state. And it just seems to me like on Mendenhall Lake and Mendenhall River, my understanding was community was pretty happy with it. They didn't particularly want motorized traffic on it. And I'm just wondering if that was the best use of resources to go ahead and assert and spend the state dollars on that when there might be other areas where we could spend it where the community wanted a change.
All right, thank you. So back to DNR. Let's see, we're talking with Deputy Commissioner Goodrum, I believe, and we are moving on to slide 19.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In addition to our waterways, Alaska's got a vast network of RS-2477 rights-of-ways that often provide the only land-based public access to many areas statewide. Many of these right-of-ways cross federal lands and conservation system units across the state. Even when located within these boundaries of a federal CSU, a valid RS-2477 remains a property interest of the state and remains subject to state ownership, management, and control. Next slide. The image on the left is an image of DOT's road network. And if you compare it with the image that's on the right side of the page, which is a image of DOT's road network plus the RS-2477 network that's been codified by the legislature displayed on that map. As you can see, the Dalton Highway itself is an RS-2477 and is a critically important road and access way in our state. I'll pause for any questions.
Seeing none, DC Crow or DC Goodrum.
Yes, ma'am. Next slide. In the spring of 2022, the DNR launched an innovative project. DNR commenced field work that would seek the quiet title to all known RS-2477 rights of way in an entire federal conservation system unit. This is breaking with previous history of litigating the validity of an RS-2477 right of way route by route and mile by mile. Within the Yukon Charlie Rivers National Preserve, there are eight RS-2477s that create a transportation network in conjunction with the state's navigable waters. In December of 2022, a 180-day notice was filed. On the picture to your right, that's a picture of RST-67, which is the Eagle to Circle Mail Trail, and it's approximately 190 miles in length. That's part of this network. This coming season, we'll have more field work that will be done, but last year we were out in the field on numerous occasions documenting and preparing for this important endeavor. I'll pause to see if there's any questions.
No questions. I'll let you move on.
And I believe I will turn the slide deck over to either the commissioner or John Crowther in the room.
Looks like Deputy Commissioner Crowther.
Thank you, Chair Giesel and members of the committee. For the record, John Crowther, Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Natural Resources. I was going to provide, just as a kind of tag in, a few quick slides here on the Willow Project, the broader National Petroleum Reserve Alaska, or NPRA, the development in the 1002 area, the coastal plain of ANWR, and then a little bit about the Ambler Road Project and the associated federal authorizations and issues that we see with each one of those. So I'll start with the Willow Project. It's obviously been a topic of both media and public interest and tremendous interest to the state and the department in recent times because of some of the significant federal permitting decisions that we're right on the verge of. So a little bit of history about the project. I believe permitting originally commenced in 2018 on the current the environmental impact statement for the Willow Master Development Plan. So a facility in the National Petroleum Reserve in the Beartooth unit that ultimately would lead to the production of 180,000 barrels per day at peak rates. So that permitting project began. It's happening in the context of what's called an Integrated Activity Plan, an IAP, which is the framework regulation for the entire National Petroleum Reserve area. And so it's from the state's perspective, we participated in all those permitting and review processes at the federal level, so very extensively studied. But in any event, we did see Willow supplemental EIS that was completed after the original EIS. Point to highlight for the committee here is just the repetition of review. The project proponent requested a supplemental EIS to respond to community input after the original EIS developed in 2018. So when that was issued, it was subject to litigation, subject to a judicial remand, and that remand has been being reviewed by the Bureau of Land Management, which is the federal agency responsible for managing this area. So that supplemental EIS on remand has just been finalized by the Bureau of Land Management. We saw a final SEIS published February 1st, so just the beginning of this month. The Federal Administrative Procedures Act says that the record of decision, so the final agency position on that review has to be issued after 30 days. There's a 30-day cooling off period. From the state perspective, we believe that the federal government should and is in a sense obligated to issue that record of decision as soon as possible, consistent with the remand. We believe the documents developed fully address the judicial remand, And so we'd hope to see that record or decision issued as soon as 30 days to the day after February 1st. But hopefully in early March, we'd receive what's called a record of decision. That would be the final approval for the project, we hope. It would approve an alternative that's developable, so allows the necessary activities to produce that resource. And we would expect, of course, that litigation would continue on that issued agency decision, that the same parties that challenged the original SEIS would challenge this SEIS. The state would, of course, we believe it's in the state's interest to see this project, after all this years of review, move forward. So we would anticipate joining in any litigation were it to be filed. And so I guess I'll pause for questions on the status of the Willow project, but can also talk a little bit about the IAP and the litigation we've seen there as well.
Questions, Senator Wilikowski.
On anticipated performance, you're talking about $8 to $17 billion. And my understanding is the state doesn't get any royalties on Willow. Is that accurate?
Yeah, so, Senator Wilikowski, through the chair, the Willow project on federal lands, pursuant to the for the federal law that allocates the royalty interest for those federal lands in the MPRA, directs its 50% to the federal government, 50% to the state of Alaska, but it goes, pursuant to the federal law, into a fund or into meeting needs of communities most impacted or proximate to the development. The state law has set up a program managed through the Department of Commerce, the Impact Assistance Program for the MPRA, for the villages that are on the North Slope. So they're able to, under existing law in that program, apply for grant funds. The royalties go into that fund. They're able to apply for grants from that fund, and those meet community needs and projects. And so this would be a significantly increased, were Willow to move into full development, the amount of royalty funds going into the state and then into that program would significantly increase.
And I saw a flyer from, I think it was ConocoPhillips, which said the projected amount that the state of Alaska would receive in property tax payments, corporate income taxes, and severance taxes is about $1.3 billion over the life. Is that sound about right?
Depending on how the life is assessed, I think that may be in a 20-year time frame analyzed in the EIS. Please don't quote me on that, not to be informal. But, you know, as we saw with Prudhoe Bay, it had a 20-year project life, and here we are on year 50, or going on year 50. So I think that's a generally approximate number for that initial project period.
And when the field is being developed, it's going to cost anywhere from, I've heard, $8 to $10 billion, somewhere in that range. Does that sound about right?
I believe that's accurate.
Just to pick an even round number, if it's $10 billion, the state, under the tax structure, Conoco gets to write off 35% of the costs on the taxes they pay to the state. So the state would be writing off $3.5 billion in production taxes over the life of the development, and then getting back $1.3 billion in production taxes. And corporate income taxes and property taxes. Does that sound about right?
Senator Wilikowski, through the chair, conceptually and from a framework perspective, there is that expense and write-off aspects as the project is developed and that those initial investments are made. I believe the Department of Revenue, in response to some prior questions from this committee, is working on a more specific estimation of the revenues and some of those tax provisions as they apply to the Willow project that I think would be available within a week's time for the committee.
Thank you. Senator Kaufman, did you have a question?
Yes, ma'am. Thank you. Through the chair, on the integrated action plan, it's got three things I like. It's one, it's a plan. I'm just curious, how all-encompassing is that? So Do we have an integrated action plan for primacy, and is this part of it? So what's the scope of the integrated action plan?
Yeah, thank you for the question, Senator Kaufman. Through the chair, it's a little bit of a game of semantics. The integrated activity plan is essentially a federal land management plan for the full reserve, and so it lays out at a very basic level where there might be oil and gas leases, where infrastructure might be appropriate, also where that might not. And so it's kind of We similarly at the state level do analogous land management plans for state lands. Federal agencies do land management plans for other federal lands. For some reason in the NPRA, it has a unique name, the Integrated Activity Plan.
Follow-up, Senator Coffin?
Yeah, thank you. So I said action activity. You know,
yes, sir.
You know what I meant. So, okay. And I guess primacy, so I think it's incredibly important. I don't know how we can really comply with our Constitution unless we're able to control our destiny. But I guess what I'd like to learn more of at some point in the future is kind of what the master plan for primacy. Questions I heard before were referring to resources for seeking primacy in certain areas. If there's somehow like a risk ranking, some of this is reactive, but is there some way that we're actually picking good projects for primacy, proactive as well as reacting to some of the emergent issues? And just seeing that IAP there, that just kind of brought it to a point I had to ask. Thank you.
Actually, Senator Kaufman, this is John Boyle, Commissioner Designee for the record, just to kind of further add a little color to your initial inquiry. You know, the state has some serious reservations about the 2013 IAP. In particular, you know, the 2013 IAP put well over 50% of the NPRA off limits to oil and gas development, and it created expansive special areas where not only does the BLM prohibit oil and gas development, but they prohibit any kind of surface development, so that it could include roads, pipelines, and other infrastructures. And the 2013 IAP was actually developed at a time when there was more of a focus on the potential for offshore Chukchi Sea development. And so some of the transportation corridors envisioned by the Department of the Interior were more focused on, you know, potentially having a pipeline coming across the North Slope from Wainwright. But the 2013 IAP, from the position of the local stakeholders, namely the North Slope Borough, the Arctic Slope Regional Corporation, and the Inupiaq community of the Arctic Slope, which is the regional tribal organization that represents the North Slope, found some serious flaws in BLM's methodology. And there were a number of times when the local stakeholders, you know, approached the Interior about the fact that, you know, in their minds, some of these management decisions would have significant impacts on communities, their ability to build infrastructure, significant impacts on, you know, potential development and property tax revenues for the region. And as a result of some of that pushback at the time under then Secretary Ken Salazar, this is back in the Obama administration, the Interior Department did create in the 2013 Record of Decision an NPRA working group, which is ostensibly created to give local stakeholders more input. But this, you know, current iteration goes back to kind of all the bad things that were originally contained, and the mechanisms for the local input, you know, really aren't there. And so there are a number of reasons why the IAP, you know, is troublesome, certainly has bad precedent in terms of, you know, making the NPRA more a conservation unit than an area where oil and gas can be developed responsibly.
Thank you. Further questions?
No, ma'am.
Seeing none. We'll move on to, I don't know the number of the slide, I think it's 23, and more update, it looks like.
Thank you, Chair Giesel. John Crowther, again, Deputy Commissioner for the record. And I would just note one last thing on integrated activity plan. Litigation does continue. The Department of Law can brief more on Friday about the status of that. But like all these issues, we have been in litigation, we are in litigation, and we expect litigation to continue. For the ANWR update, I'll start with a frame up. The 2017 Tax Cuts and Jobs Act authorized leasing and development in the coastal plain of ANWR, the 1002 area. Under that law, there was required to be a initial lease sale. The federal government did conduct that lease sale. It occurred in early 2021 is when I believe the leases were formally issued. Very shortly after that lease sale occurred, the new federal administration came in, the Biden administration, and took a number of actions that have affected both those lease rights that were issued and the broader program. However, that program is still on the books. There's still an obligation in federal law to allow the development, and there's still an obligation to hold a second lease sale by the end of 2024. So first, on the status of the leases, part of the new administrative actions in early 2021 was a suspension order that those leases, no activities could occur on them, that they were essentially told or paused. That is an area that the lessees, in this case ADA, the other two private companies that had leases in the coastal plain, have since relinquished their leases due to the delays and suspensions. But the ADA continues to hold its leases and is pursuing litigation along with the state to challenge the validity of that suspension, that it's inconsistent with the framework of regulations and laws that, that direct the development to go forward, that it doesn't have a basis in an identified error or authority. Stepping back to the program as a whole, in addition to the lease suspension, the Biden administration also initiated a new EIS for the leasing program under law. So they are revising the federal review documents that authorized the first lease sale, with the potential and stated intent of having new federal review documents and conditions for the second lease sale. And so that the leasing program will, that's a necessary precursor, according to the actions the administration has taken, for that lease sale to occur. So we would expect to see a supplemental EIS or a new EIS document, federal review, within likely the next year and a half, if they're going to meet that timeline. The state is a cooperating agency there, that we understand work has begun, but is not proceeding perhaps according to the timelines originally laid out by the agency that they intended to complete that. And I think that's end of update. Waiting for questions, of course.
Yes, Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you. Under the Statehood Act, Alaska was to get 90% of the royalties on federal lands for oil development, and in ANWR, we're not getting 90%, we're getting, I think, 50%. And the legislature, at least the Senate, has passed resolutions in support of getting a 90% as per the Statehood Act. And I'm just curious if the state has looked at litigation to challenge the 50% royalty split, which would be in pretty clear violation of the Statehood Act.
Yeah, Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, I don't want to speak for what the Department of Law and the authorities they may have to challenge that. I will say that as a general operating matter in the U.S. Congress, the authority of Congress to adjust that percentage, which was laid out at 90-10, has been asserted. And the Congress has exercised it previously in the MPRA when they adjusted that ratio, which, you know, from a philosophical perspective of the state, it's not fair, it's not appropriate, it's not consistent with the Statehood Act. But from a perspective of advancing then the National Petroleum Reserves, or the appropriations amendments that allowed the development in the MPRA, and then the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, the conception that 50% of something is much more valuable than 90% of nothing, I think, was the actionable compromise that was made by the U.S. Congress.
Follow up.
And I just don't recall the case law on that. NPA, for example, that's billions of dollars lost to the state. Is there a clear case law on that, on the Congress's ability to just unilaterally change the Statehood Act, which is the act upon which we came into this state, into this country?
Again, for the record, Corey Mills, Deputy Attorney General. Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, that is a perennial question we look at within the department. I believe there, if you look at the cases, we did bring federal claims in federal claims court in, this is a long time ago, 80s or early 90s, a case asserting the Statehood Act. In that case, they said the provisions we were looking at were ones that could be changed and it wasn't a contract. So that's really what you have to look at. Is it a contract provision that, you know, they have to uphold, or is it more like a statute? And Statehood Acts, as I recall, there's, you have to do a certain test to determine that, and it's not very clear. So it's definitely something we're interested in and have looked at, but it's very nuanced in terms of when it applies and when it doesn't.
Yeah, just follow up, but I guess a request I would make for as we go forward with Willow, which this is billions of dollars to the state of Alaska potentially. I mean, we lost $1 billion with the leases in Beaufort and Chukchi Sea, a couple billion dollars actually, because of the way we didn't get the same royalties that they got in the Gulf of Mexico. We will be losing billions of dollars under what we were promised under the Statehood Act. So I'd like to hear from the Department of Law at some point on this. If there's, you know, I appreciate, you know, protecting the state's interest. This is billions of dollars to the state of Alaska. And if there is any daylight at all for you to file that lawsuit, I would really urge you to do that. I'd be more than happy to support funding for that. And so, I'd be curious to hear it. And we could do it in office and as well. I'd just be curious to hear why we're not pursuing that, if we're not pursuing that. Thank you.
Happy to do that.
Thank you. All right, we can move on to the next slide.
Thank you, Chair Giesel. And I'll just out of just respect for the committee's time and my colleagues, I'll move quickly through this slide. But this is about an update on the Ambler Mine District, the Ambler Road Project, particularly the federal issues associated with it. Like all these large projects, this had a federal NEPA review, National Environmental Policy Act, an EIS was developed, and that resulted in 2020. A joint record of decision between the Bureau of Land Management and the Army Corps of Engineers. That followed the leases issued by the Park Service. This does cross the gates of the Arctic National Park and Preserve, as well as leases by the BLM for the areas close to the Dalton Highway. Shortly after the issuance of those, the record of decision, and then the issuance of the leases themselves in January 2021, in late 2020, litigation was filed and began in the district court. Ultimately, that court case, the Bureau of Land Management accepted a voluntary remand of the essentially acceding to the points raised by the plaintiffs and asking for the record of decision back to be revised and reviewed. Accordingly, the Bureau of Land Management has begun a supplemental environmental impact statement in response to that remand. They are represented that it'll be published and released this year, but we have not yet seen a draft of it. While that voluntary remand is ongoing, they've suspended the right-of-way, so project work cannot continue, and there's active litigation about the scope of that the state is participating in, about the scope of what has been suspended versus what is still able to move forward under preliminary work, including work on state or private.
Thank you. I see no questions. Thank you for that presentation. It looks like we're going now to Deputy Commissioner Ben Mulligan with the Alaska Department of Fish and Wildlife, Fish and Game.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. For the record, my name is Ben Mulligan, and I am the Deputy Commissioner for the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. My commissioner sends his regrets. He is currently at a Pacific Salmon Commission meeting, which I guess coincidentally is representing the state of Alaska's interests in protecting our fishing rights at the treaty meeting. So it's a little funny that he's there instead of here, because you all know how much he takes an active role in the legislature and these hearings. So let's see if I can. So just to kind of cover, you know, where we're coming from as a department and the state on our right to manage and what we do to do that, and really the impetus of, you know, what a lot of what, you know, the commissioner does and part of what I do to assist him is to protect our right to manage our fish and game resource and their uses. And we do that in a lot of ways before we even discuss potential litigation with the Department of Law, is to ensure that the best information is being presented in these federal processes. You know, this slide has kind of an Endangered Species Act feel, but I mean, we provide the best information when it comes to ESA, Marine Mammal Protection Act, but then also to the federal land management agencies when they're going through their process for their management plans. We also actively engage in providing up-to-date information along with our colleagues at DNR to make sure that, as they've spoken about, access is paramount because, as you know, I mean, Alaskans love to get out, not just to enjoy the outdoors, you know, visually, but also it's important. Those RS-2477s are important to go on and fishing on. So where do we view that we get that right to manage? And as I think any Alaskan knows, a large part of our fight for statehood had to do with fish and game management. And when the statehood compact came about, there was a large section about who could manage fish and game. And then part of that was having the legislature as a body set that framework for management. So you had then in 1959, President Eisenhower issued that executive order recognizing that set of statutes and kind of affirming that the state has control of its fish and game resources. And then again, with the passage of ANILCA, those rights were affirmed. So, you know, our bottom line is the state is the primary manager of fish and game on all lands throughout Alaska. We are the ones that are actively out there assessing those populations, regardless of land status, because, you know, we have an obligation to the people of Alaska to assess and manage those populations. So why is this important? I think I just touched on it a little bit. You know, food security, continuing that hunting and fishing heritage is a hugely important issue to us, and I think, you know, a large majority of Alaskans. But, you know, that right to manage also comes into play when it comes to developing our resources and access, because when you're talking about Endangered Species Act listings, those don't just have a huge impact on us as a department and managing that species. It also has a large impact on what the state, local political subdivisions want to do within those areas where that endangered species has been listed. Next slide. So, you know, what do we do? And really, it's our bread and butter. It's what we're best at, is collecting and utilizing that sound science to inform those federal decision processes. And we do that in a lot of ways. And as I come through the slides, I'll give you examples and I'll elaborate on that a little more. So in particular, and, you know, one I've talked about is, you know, informing the Endangered Species Act potential listing decisions. And these are just a couple of examples that I've put up. And in all of these situations, some are ongoing, but, you know, examples like yellow cedar, we worked with the Department of Natural Resources Division of Forestry to look at that population, present good information, and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service did not choose to list that species. I'm going to talk more about it later, but the other example I'll point out is Southeast Alaska wolves. It's hit the paper in a lot of ways. It's more of a, I would say, more folks know about it. You know, the first two listings, the information that we provide helped inform, and I guess what I should say is we're putting forward the best information that shows that these populations don't meet the criteria for an Endangered Species Act listing. This isn't, you know, it's not a message that we're crafting. This is hard science that shows the population, you know, it's meeting our management objectives. And so we can show kind of that objective hard science of what's really going on with these populations. You know, the next is when you're looking at some of the biological opinions and incidental take provisions within the Endangered Species Act and the Marine Mammal Protection Act for species, you know, once they're listed. You know, in particular, I think one of that is probably of interest to the committee is the polar bear incidental take regulations and what we're doing there. And I'll elaborate on that a little later. And also, you know, the ring seal listing and the critical habitat designations, not just for that population, but for the other ice seal populations.
Pardon me, DC Mulligan. We are past 5 o'clock. This is a presentation, so I know that many committee members have meetings scheduled after 5 p.m. So if you need to go, by all means, feel free to do that. This is recorded so that you can complete the hearing by tuning in, listening to it later. But I would like D.C. Mulligan to be able to continue his presentation. We are going to have Department of Law before us on Friday. We're also going to shoehorn in the Willow resolution. So be prepared for some prompt activity on Friday. Please continue, D.C. Mulligan.
No problem. Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. So, you know, the other thing we do is we participate in these processes, as I alluded to before. And one way that, a large part of my duties and responsibility lies is our participation with the Federal Subsistence Program. As you know, there is a Federal Subsistence Program with its own board who takes action on federal public lands as it relates to federal subsistence. We comment on every proposal that comes in front of that board. We also participate in their regional advisory councils, similar to, as you may be familiar with, our state advisory committees. In particular, in this regard, I will say we provide an overwhelming amount of the data that is used in this process. Our biologists are prized to come in front of that committee or in front of that board and those councils to speak, because the federal land agencies do some assessment of populations, but they do not do a majority of it, not enough to analyze any of their proposals in order to determine if they should pass them or not. And the second part, sometimes we do end up being involved in lawsuits that are going on with other parties. We have information, so we engage in those. And one is, intervening with the polar bear incidental take regulation suit. A couple of things that we're doing to help inform not only the federal process, but that suit is conducting studies on snow modeling. Right now, it sounds silly to say, but there's an expert on snow depth, and we have engaged with that individual to create real-time mapping of snow depths so we can better inform federal processes to determine where polar bear dens will occur. Because that is a huge thing when it comes to this incidental take regulation, because you can't have activities happening within a mile radius. So, for example, when we did a similar talk in front of another body, I used it from the Denina Center to the Old Glen. Now it's from here to the Juneau Yacht Club. That's as the crow flies, that's a mile. So that's your halo. So we need to know where those likely dens are going to occur. And then the other thing we're doing is we're analyzing existing literature and existing studies to tease out whether or not those disturbances are actually detrimental to those polar bears, and trying to determine what is best for the activities that can occur and, of course, the polar bears who are living in the area. So sometimes, we present the best data that we have available, the best data that we've gone out and collected, and sometimes, they'll still make the call. And the example here that I alluded to earlier was ring seals, and in particular also in a wider range, because it also falls under the umbrella of ice seals. So we felt that listing was not necessary. The population is at an all-time high. Ice seals have millions of seals within their range right now. And when they designated critical habitat, they basically took everything north of St. Matthews Island, went north, and then swung around into the Arctic. If you combine it with all of the different ice seal designations, you're about 350,000 square miles of ocean is what they've designated as critical habitat. But you know, when we look at that, that's their habitat, not critical habitat. And so, you know, the other example up here is humpback whale critical habitat. You know, when they look at Alaska and their designations, they kind of do a wholesale kind of blanket for critical habitat. But if we look just, across the way in the Atlantic, when they designate whale critical habitat, they're very, they come in and they're very pointed. They take that a feeding habitat. They take that rearing habitat for juveniles, and they designate it. So there's not like here where you basically have all marine waters. They have very designated areas to protect what is critical, not just the blanket habitat of that species. This is our last slide, and just to give you a flavor of what some of the things that might be talked about on Friday is all the different pieces of litigation. Some of these are statehood defense dollar spends, and some of them are just what, you know, weird spending as a department in the state to try to assert the state's right to manage its fish and game resources. So more to come on Friday, but I just wanted to put that up to give an example of what you all are seeing us do. So thank you, Madam Chair. Really appreciate it.
Thank you very much. DC Mulligan, questions? All right, seeing none. Senator Kaufman.
Thank you. Through the chair, I just want to say I think this is a critical issue, being able to control our own access to our own state and being able to comply with our own constitution with respect to developing, you know, the promise of our resources. So I'm thankful for this, and I hope we succeed. As I was saying before, I'm interested in kind of learning how we're prioritizing all of this. So to the extent, that I can see kind of what maybe some of it needs to be held close because it's strategic, but to the extent that we have a kind of a master plan for primacy, I would like more information around that if it's possible. So thank you.
Thank you. Yes, Commissioner.
Through the chair, Senator Kaufman, for the record, Jason Bruni, D.C. Commissioner, thank you for that. And I think we would love any input from members of this group on things we should be prioritizing. I think Senator Wilikowski, your idea earlier is fantastic. That will definitely be on the agenda of the next meeting. And so any input, Chair Giesel, that we can get from this committee or from any of your colleagues, we would love to bring that, put that on the agenda and have that discussion. So thank you, Senator Kaufman.
Briefly.
Thank you. So biggest bang for the buck is what we want to go for, I think. Just.
Thank you, commissioners and deputy commissioners, for your presentations. This concludes our agenda for today. The next meeting will be Friday, February 17th at 3:30. For the public, as well as the committee members, SGR 7, the National Petroleum Reserve Alaska resolution, will be the very beginning of the meeting. Then we'll be hearing from the Department of Law. At this time, the meeting is adjourned. Let the record reflect the time is 5:10 p.m.